From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we remember novelist Carol Shields. She died Wednesday after a long battle with breast cancer. She was 68. Shields was best known for her Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Stone Diaries. We'll listen back to her interview in which she talked about her life and her writing. Also, rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the Richmond Sessions, music recorded in Richmond, Virginia in the 20s, just as recording was getting off the ground. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Dirty Pretty Things, directed by Stephen Frears. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. Basketball star Kobe Bryant was charged this afternoon with sexually assaulting a woman at a Colorado resort. Nancy Greenlease reports.
Eagle County District Attorney Mark Hurlburt announced the single count of felony sexual assault against the Los Angeles Lakers star. The charge stems from a June 30th incident at a luxurious resort in Colorado. The 24-year-old Bryant is accused of attacking a 19-year-old female employee in his room. The DA said that it is alleged that Bryant used force to have sex with the woman. Bryant was staying at the hotel while he recovered from knee surgery. He will have to return to Colorado on August 6th, when he will be advised of the charges and his rights. Bryant released a statement saying that nothing that happened was against the will of the woman. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Greenlace.
An American soldier was killed today in Iraq when explosives blew up under a military convoy west of Baghdad. The bomb was detonated by remote control as the convoy moved around a traffic circle. Pentagon officials say there were no other casualties. The White House released limited excerpts from a classified document today. The document details intelligence on Iraq's nuclear ambitions before the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. The move to release the information is part of an effort to put to rest questions about now-discredited intelligence the president used in his State of the Union address. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
A senior administration official speaking on condition of anonymity said the October 2002 documents indicate that there was compelling evidence that Iraq, if unchecked, could probably have a nuclear weapon during this decade. That, he said, is what drove the president to take action. On the subject of the president's State of the Union address and that line about Iraq trying to obtain uranium from Africa, the official said it wasn't until February, weeks after that speech, that the White House found out that the assertion was based in part on forged documents. But the intelligence report does cite State Department reservations months prior to the president's speech that the claims of Iraqi pursuit of uranium in Africa are, quote, highly dubious. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
It was an unusual scene on Capitol Hill today. Democrats at a House hearing were upset because they say they'd not been given enough time to read the details of a $50 billion bill on pension funds. So they staged a boycott of the vote by going to a nearby room. The Republican committee chairman in turn called the Capitol Hill police to evict the Democrats. Later, Democratic Congressman Charles Rangel of New York said the Democrats had every right to hold a boycott.
That room belongs to us just as much as it belongs to the Republicans. So we're not arguing with you about violating the rules. But when we object it, that's the only thing that we have. You may call it a waste of time. We call it our constitutional prerogative.
Democrat Robert Matsui, meanwhile, called the attempt to evict the Democrats an abuse of power. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials and the Nasdaq both closed up. This is NPR News. The Ford Motor Company says it's planning on a 10% reduction in salaried employees by the end of the year. Officials say they hope much of that cut can come from attrition and hiring freezes, but if not, they say some employees will lose their jobs, but they did not say how many jobs will be lost. A federal court says it will not interfere with last week's controversial ruling by the Nevada State Supreme Court. The state justices had suspended a constitutional requirement for a two-thirds vote of the legislature to raise taxes. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
The case came about in an attempt to break a deadlock over the state budget. Nevada lawmakers had passed a spending plan, which requires a majority vote, but they'd been unable to come up with a tax plan to pay for it, which requires a two-thirds vote. So Nevada Governor Kenny Guinn sued the legislature for failing to fund the public schools, as required by the state's constitution. The Nevada Supreme Court ruled that the two-thirds vote was merely procedural and should not stand in the way of the more substantive requirement of funding education. The court told the legislature it could pass a tax to support the schools with a simple majority vote. Republicans in the legislature challenged the ruling, but seven U.S. justices unanimously ruled that they have no authority to find a state Supreme Court in violation of the federal Constitution. Ina Jaffe, NPR News.
Lance Armstrong kept his overall lead in the Tour de France today, but he lost more than 1.5 minutes to a major rival during individual time trials. Armstrong finished second in those trials, but he was 96 seconds behind Jan Ulrich of Germany. Ulrich won the Tour in 1997 and since then has twice been the runner-up to Armstrong. Armstrong now holds just a 34-second lead. I'm Dale Willman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from E-Trade Financial, dedicated to improving the way people invest, bank, and borrow, on the web at etrade.com or 1-800-ETRADE-1.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies. Terry Gross is out sick today, so I'm taking a day from my work at the Philadelphia Daily News to fill in for her. Today we remember writer Carol Shields. She died Wednesday after a long battle with breast cancer. She was 68. Shields is best known for her novel, The Stone Diaries, which won a 1995 Pulitzer Prize as well as a National Book Critics Circle Award. It was a bestseller in the States and a popular choice for book clubs. Success came as a surprise to Shields. She was the mother of five, started writing late, and didn't even publish her first novel until the age of 40. She wrote 10 novels, two collections of short stories, and a biography of Jane Austen. She spent most of her adult life in Canada. Her husband, Don, was dean at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg. In 1998, after she was diagnosed with breast cancer, she started writing her novel, Unless. It was to be her last. Terry Gross talked with Shields last year after the book was published. Unless is about a woman whose life is suddenly changed from relative happiness to despair when her oldest daughter falls off the track of normal life. The main character, Rita, is a 43-year-old woman in a comfortable marriage with three teenage daughters. Rita is a moderately successful writer, about to begin a new novel when her life is turned upside down. Here's the first paragraph.
It happens that I'm going through a period of great unhappiness and loss just now. All my life I've heard people speak of finding themselves in acute pain, bankrupt in spirit and body, but I've never understood what they meant. To lose, to have lost. I believed these visitations of darkness lasted only a few minutes or hours, and that these saddened people, in between bouts, were occupied, as we all were, with the useful monotony of happiness. But happiness is not what I thought. Happiness is the lucky pane of glass you carry in your head. It takes all your cunning just to hang on to it. And once it's smashed, you have to move into a different sort of life.
That's Carol Shields reading the opening of her new novel, Unless. Was the idea of great unhappiness and loss as foreign to you as it is to your main character, Rita?
Yes, I would have to say that's true. An interviewer once asked me what was the worst thing that had ever happened to me. This was somewhere in the States a few years ago. And I said, it hasn't happened yet. I couldn't think of it. But a short while after that, I had a daughter going to school at Cambridge, and she was hit by a truck. She was hit so hard that the windshield shattered on her head. And she survived that accident, in fact, came through very well. But when I think of that, and of course the breath leaves my body when I think of it, that would be the great unhappiness.
I thought you were going to say the great unhappiness was your illness. I didn't realize that had happened to you.
Well, yes, of course, and then this. But otherwise, I suppose I've lived quite a fortunate life. But when I was 63, I was suddenly diagnosed with breast cancer. And then I did have to. It did change my life from before this cancer to after the cancer. I did, of course, as everyone does, I did a lot of grieving about this and trying to pull myself back together so that I could become a working writer and a working functioning person again.
Was it hard to write again? To find, like, the focus and the interest in something outside of your own story and your own symptoms and your own prognosis?
Yes, it was very hard to start writing again. Fortunately, I did have a deadline for a book of short stories that was to be delivered March the 1st. I spent about a month not writing, not thinking. Thinking that the world does not need another book, particularly a book that I might write. But what I found was, oddly enough, was that it was something to do with myself. I had a job of work to do, and it really didn't matter what it was. I could go to my office, and I could work. And so it turned out to be a distraction, and quite a wonderful distraction.
In your novel, the main character's teenage daughter is living on a street corner under a lamppost wearing a cardboard sign on her chest that says, "Goodness." She's living basically like a homeless person, not bathing. Her hair is all matted. In your book, the characters come up with different theories, usually different feminist theories, about
yes.
why this daughter has made herself into a homeless person and sitting with that sign that says, "Goodness," around her chest. The mother
yes.
thinks, well, maybe it's because... As a woman, she's capable of thinking of goodness, but not of reaching greatness, because a woman's role is so circumscribed in the world now. And then another feminist writer thinks that Nora has simply succumbed to the traditional role of women without power. She's accepted in its stead complete powerlessness, total passivity, a kind of impotent piety. In doing nothing, she has claimed everything. You know, of course, I hope I'm not giving too much away here to say that their theories are really wrong. Do you see this book in part as being about the limitations of using social theory or feminist theory to actually understand what goes on in a person's mind?
Yes, I think, in fact, all the people who offer advice are both right and both wrong, all wrong. That is, what has led to this estrangement and this behavior is all of those things. I remember when I was a child, my childhood was in the 40s, early 30s, late 30s and early 40s. I remember my mother sitting down with the three children at the kitchen table and saying to us, "You can be anything you want, even President of the United States." And I knew, I must have been about 8 years old, I knew that wasn't true. And I knew she knew it wasn't true. It was what people said. And my own daughter, who has a daughter herself, wonders what she can say to her daughter about what she will be allowed to be and do, how much actual freedom, how much of her own life she can take hold of. So those were all the things that I was thinking about.
Rita, the main character in your novel, who's a mother and a writer, she's very conscious of being a woman writer. And she believes that sadly, men aren't interested in women's lives and that women's fiction isn't taken as seriously as men's fiction. Has that been your experience as a writer?
Yes, that has been my experience, that most that women writers tend not to be taken as seriously as male writers.
How have you felt that in your career?
Well, in a sense, I haven't objected. I mean, when people say, for example, that I am a women's writer, I mean, what does that mean, really? Does it mean I write about women? Certainly, that is true. I do. Are my readers women? Well, yes. I think there are more male readers than there used to be, but I know that the readers of my fiction are mostly women of different ages and. So if that's what it means to be a woman writer, what I was concerned about is that women characters are so seldom placed as the moral center of the novel. And if one puts a male character there instead of a woman, the novel always seems to be taken more seriously. Now, you can look at Jane Austen's novels, of course, as great exceptions. I think they are. I think the women they're certainly the center of those novels. And they were the first novels I ever read, by the way, that in which there were intelligent women. But Of course, these women want to secure marriages for themselves, advantageous marriages. And one thinks at that point is where they lose their moral authority that they have built up in the book. I think it's very hard writing novels seriously about serious women.
As your main character is writing her comic novel about Alicia and Roman, the couple she's writing about, she says, I must start thinking seriously about Alicia and Roman's sex life. I have to be braver about it this time around. An awful maidenly daintiness runs through the pages of my previous book, a prudery that has nothing to do with sex in the 21st century. What are some of the difficulties you've faced in your books writing about sex? What are some of the stages you've gone through in trying to figure out how to do it?
How do you do it? Well, the problem is the language of sex is so eroded. There are just so many phrases. This is why they have these marvelous competitions to find out who writes the worst sex scene of the year. It's very hard to write about something like this. And then he pressed his lips against her. Then he kissed her full on the mouth, etc., etc. To do it freshly, to do it again, I found that difficult. I found it difficult because of my generation, because I am now 66, and I came through the period where I think Ernest Hemingway was not allowed to say damn in his novels. He had to say darn. Those were the books I was reading. Sex was veiled pretty much from us. And then I was always thinking, of course, conscious of the fact that I had children, and I had children who went to school, and I was concerned about them thinking about their mother writing sex scenes. I realize this sounds a bit ridiculous, but I did go through that.
What did you think it would say about you if your children found out that mom wrote sex scenes?
I think they would have been embarrassed with, among their friends. So I wrote sort of around the sex scenes instead of directly into them.
In your book, The Stone Diaries, the novel that won the Pulitzer Prize, you're following the life of a woman who's born in 1905 and lives to the age of 85. So it covers most of the 20th century, but because she's born in 1905, she's actually very I shouldn't say because she's born then, but you're talking about generations. You know, her generational style was to be very uncomfortable with sexuality. I think for her, sex was more of a mysterious duty than anything else. Was it easy for you to find her point of view about sex and to write about her point of view?
I had a mother born in 1902, and I remember my mother did very well compared to most mothers, talking about such things. I remember that she took us to the Art Institute in Chicago, and she told us before we went in very carefully that we would be seeing unclothed men and women statues in the Art Institute, and that the human body was a beautiful thing. But at home, she dressed in the closet. And so there was another side to her. And I never thought of this as hypocrisy. I felt she was trying to work this out in her own mind and just had a little trouble getting it all together. She did very well, I think, in talking to us about sex. I think she did better than I did with my children, in fact. But there was a lot that she missed. And I don't know if I should say this, but I can remember when I was packing for my honeymoon, this would be 1957, and the honeymoon was a week long. She wanted to make sure I had 7 nightgowns because she said, rather obliquely, it's actually awfully messy. So that was the message I got about the sexual life that awaited me.
So has writing about sexuality become more comfortable over the years for you?
Well, I don't do it as well as some people do. I think other people are able to do it better than I do. But I do realize that it is part of all our lives, and you really can't miss it out altogether.
Well, I will say that in your new book, the main character is very comfortable with sex and really seems to enjoy it with her husband. Not that that's at the center of the book, but it's almost like a sanctuary for them in this terrible time. It's something that they can still partake in and appreciate.
Yes, yes. So perhaps you're saying it has got easier. And of course, my children have grown up, and
that's right.
and we're living in a different era.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Writer Carol Shields speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with writer Carol Shields, recorded last year. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her novel, The Stone Diaries. Shields died earlier this week after a long battle with breast cancer.
The Stone Diaries is set in the past. It begins in around 1905 and continues through most of the 20th century. Do you feel like you were able to use a different voice from your contemporary fiction voice because this novel is about an older woman, and because so much of it is set in an earlier part of the 20th century?
Yes, what you're talking about actually gave me enormous pleasure in the writing of this book, and I don't think I ever wrote with more happiness than when I wrote the Stone Diaries. I did feel that sense of a period phrase. I can remember, for example, my mother sang to us Lickety Split, and I remember saying it to my children, but my children don't say it. And so I was very interested in finding period phrases and getting them into the right era. And do you know the expression, I'll see you in the movies?
No.
It means just, I'll see you around. And I didn't know when that came into currency, but one of my colleagues at the university was able to pin that one down for me to 1929. So I was interested in that kind of thing and the style of writing. But the book is really about life filtered through Daisy Goodwill's own brain.
She's the main character.
She's the main character through her consciousness. She was a woman who cared deeply what other people thought about her. And so everything, all the other voices are really filtered through her consciousness. So that was a very interesting psychological puzzle, and it also involved a kind of historical puzzle because people did speak and wrote letters very differently in 1910 than they did later on. And I read magazines. I read some old newspapers, especially the society columns, to get a sense of that voice and that period sound.
In addition to phrases that are now archaic, what are some of the differences you found in conversation and writing style from the early 1900s?
Well, people mostly were more formal in their speech. But, of course, they were more silent. I always think that the greatest tragedy of our parents' lives, people of my generation, is that so much went unsaid, unspoken, unshared. So many silences, such fear of emotion, such fear of breaking taboos. I don't honestly believe that the consciousness of an early 20th century person is very much different than the consciousness of today's society. But I think the language is different, the use of language, the sparsity of language between people, the number of things that weren't in the narrative, that were left out of the narrative.
A lot of reading groups, book clubs, chose your book as a book to read. And in fact, at the back of one of the paperback editions of the Stone Diaries, there are questions that reading groups can use as discussion points. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about having like,
a
list
very,
of... Yeah.
I feel very negative about that.
Uh-huh.
I think anyone who picks up a book should not have to get to a quiz at the end of it. And I never had it again and never want to. They do the book club guides now, of course, over the Internet. But I don't like the idea of this being bound into the book. It changes the book as we know it and the shape of the book, the arc of the book. So I don't think it's a good idea. I belong to a book club. We wouldn't have used a reader's guide for anything in the world.
Why not?
Well, we set our own agenda.
Right.
We had our own questions, our own experiences to bring to the reading. I think we would have felt put upon. But I know, I also know people who welcome that kind of direction.
Writer Carol Shields speaking with Terry Gross, recorded last year. We'll hear more of their interview in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Elegant Gathering of White Snows, a novel about eight women whose impromptu walking quest touches a nation, by Chris Radish. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with novelist Carol Shields. She died Wednesday at the age of 68. Ed Ward tells us about the search for music around Virginia and Tennessee during America's first recording boom. And David Edelstein reviews Stephen Frears' new film, Dirty Pretty Things.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Carol Shields. She died earlier this week of complications from breast cancer. Her best-selling novel, The Stone Diaries, won a 1995 Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Critics Circle Award. Her last novel, Unless, was written after she was diagnosed with breast cancer. It's about a 43-year-old wife, mother, and writer who's experiencing profound unhappiness for the first time in her life. Shields is the author of 10 novels, but she didn't get started until relatively late in life. Her first novel was published when she was 40.
You were married when you were 22, and you had 5 children in 10 years. Did you fall in love with motherhood?
I loved motherhood. People were having large families. This was through the 60s. I loved children. I was interested in children. I would say it was a wonderful period of my life. I think I thought it would go on forever, but of course it doesn't. The children gradually become more and more independent and gradually and quite quickly, leave home. So I've had an empty nest since 1985.
Uh-huh. That's when the last child left home?
Yeah, yes.
And how did you discover feminism?
I discovered feminism late. I came to feminism late. I knew there was something wrong. I just didn't know what it was. But of course, I, like many American women, I read Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. And I have to say, it was like a thunderbolt. I was astonished. I had no idea women thought like that, or women could be anything other than what they were. That was in the early 60s. I read that book. It did change the way I thought about myself. I did begin to do a graduate degree part-time, thought about doing some writing. It gave me courage.
Is that when you started writing?
Yes, it was about the same time, and that was probably something of a coincidence of time that my fifth child, and she was going half days to school, and I just had a little bit of time, and I was writing poetry in those days. I was very interested in poetry for about 5 years, in reading it and writing it. And eventually, these were just published in small magazines in Canada. One of the professors at the University of Ottawa said, "Well, look, we're in the publishing business. If you have 50 poems, we'll publish a book." So that, in fact, is what they did. And then they published another book 2 years later. So I had the two early books of poetry before I sat down to write a novel.
As much as you loved being a mother, as a mother of 5 who was just kind of discovering feminism and discovering that you liked to write and had a gift for writing, did you ever resent all the responsibilities of motherhood?
No. I can't think now why I didn't resent it. You know, the lives of middle-class women of my generation were rather predictable. The idea that we would marry, even those of us who had a degree, we would marry, we would have children, I would have dinner parties. I didn't know women who did really other things, so I expected that I would do this. It was a very happy period of my life. I have to say this, I think I had very nice children. It doesn't seem to me that it was a difficult period. No, it was. There were people all around me doing the same thing. My women friends, my coffee clutch friends, were all doing this too. And I sometimes think that the old coffee clutch idea is belittled. But for us, this was the beginning of feminism for many of us. This is where we talked about these things for the first time.
How did you find time to write as the mother of 5, particularly when your children were young?
You know, everyone asks me this, including my own children. But what my children forget is that I did not have a job. So they're all raising children and having jobs, but I didn't have a job. So I didn't write until they went to school. And I didn't write on weekends, and I didn't write in the evening. None of this was possible. But I used to try to get that hour just before they came home for lunch, 11 to 12. You know, got all the socks picked up, etc. And then I tried to write a couple of pages. That was all I ever asked myself to do. Then sometimes in the afternoon, before they came home from school, I would get back to those two pages and maybe have a chance to do them over again. But I really only had about an hour or an hour and a half a day. But it's funny because now I have the whole day and my output is no more than it was then. But this was how I organized that time, that I would give myself, I wanted two pages a day. And if I didn't get to my two pages, I would get into bed at night with one of those, you know, those thick yellow tablets of lined paper. And I would do two quick pages and then turn off the light. Mm-hmm. And so that I did this for 9 months. And at the end of 9 months, I had a novel. And I never wrote as quickly again. I never wrote in such an organized way again. But it was, I could see how it could be done in little units. I thought of it like boxcars. I had 9 boxcars, and each chapter had a title, starting with September, and then October, November, December. So it was a very easy structure for someone writing a first novel to follow.
And is that the novel that was published, Small Ceremony?
Yes, yes.
So you were 40 when that was actually published.
Yes, I was.
I know that you have stage 4 breast cancer. Was it an act of faith to start a novel and expect to live at least until the end of it? Or were you given a kind of good enough prognosis that that wasn't an issue?
I wanted something to do. I wanted work to do. I didn't think I could finish it. My last few novels have been rather long. This one is a little shorter. And then I had a surgical procedure, which gave me 3 excellent months, where some of my old energy came back to me. So I had those months to finish the novel. And I was astonished that at the end of August, one day I looked up and I realized I had finished the novel, and I was so happy. I wanted to run out in the street and give people money and take in their mending. I don't remember ever finishing a novel and being so happy about it. And I suppose, I don't know, it was a marvelous blessing.
I want to read you another sentence from the Stone Diaries, and This is from a chapter that takes place in 1985 when the main character is 80 years old. And she says, "Suddenly her body is all that matters. How it's let her down and how fundamentally lonely it is to live inside a body year after year and carry it always in a forward direction and how there is never any relief from the weight of it, even when sleeping, even when joined briefly to the body of another." How does that read to you now?
It reads to me like something I would say today. The body that we live in, the changing body, the aging body, the ailing body. I think we're very conscious. We can't really get away from it. I suppose we have to find a place of protection. And think as well of ourselves as we can during this particular period.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people are very concerned with having a legacy and artistic output that will outlive them. Now that you are ill, does it matter any more or less to you that you will have your books as a legacy?
You know, people think that would make a difference. People say this to me, "At least you've written your books." The kind of people who say, "What have I done in my life, etc." But the fact is, I don't think that. I'm a realist, and I know the shelf life of a book is about 4 months. The day that I got the Pulitzer Prize, I met Margot Jefferson, and she said, "You know what this means, don't you?" And I said, "No, what?" And she said, you already know the first line of your obituary. And of course, I do. And that I found that rather frightening. But someone sent me a list of all the Pulitzer Prize winners since something like 1915, I think. And half of them I'd never heard of. Half of them. So I don't think literary reputations live on. Very few of them. Books, you know, fall out of the public eye. So I don't have a sense of leaving anything permanent at all. I suppose one thinks of one's children as what you leave permanently, and their children. Naturally, I like to write books that people enjoy reading, but the literary legacy, no, it's very unimportant to me.
Mm-hmm. I know you're not well. I know you have cancer. Are you afraid of death?
No, I'm not afraid of death. I've had three years, kind of bonus years, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just one instant away from being alive. I don't think it's far away at all. And I'm not afraid of it at all, or anything involved with it.
Well, Carol Shields, I really appreciate your talking with us, and I wish you the best. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Writer Carol Shields speaking with Terry Gross last year. She was the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel The Stone Diaries. Her last novel was Unless. Shields died earlier this week. Coming up, some early music recordings from the 1920s. This is Fresh Air. The American record business was shocked in 1923 when fiddler John Carson sold hundreds of thousands of copies of his record, The Little Old Log Cabin in the Lane, and proved that white rural Southerners bought records. Soon they discovered that black Southerners did too, and the race was on for talent. Usually talent scouts relied on local informants, but sometimes they just set up in a city to see what happened. Music historian Ed Ward reports on one of the stranger casting calls from that era.
In July 1927, the RCA Victor Company sent Ralph Peer to Bristol, a town on the Virginia-Tennessee border, with a portable recording studio, advancing him with ads in the local newspapers saying they were looking for talent. At the end of the 10-day period, Peer had discovered and signed both Jimmy Rogers and the Carter family, laying the foundations for commercial country music and providing America with two of its first superstar acts. Peer had begun his career in 1923 at OK Records, which specialized in hillbilly and race, which is to say black, acts. OK was quite a successful label, and among its finds were Mississippi John Hurt, the Stoneman family, Frank Hutchison, and Roosevelt Sykes, all important pioneers in their varied fields. Like many other labels, it copied RCA's Bristol strategy, and recently Rob Curry, a Richmond punk rocker and former member of the band Guar, compiled a double CD of the last of these sessions, held in October 1929 in Richmond, Virginia. Like the more celebrated Bristol sessions, this is a snapshot of what Grill Marcus has called the old weird America, a snapshot of what ordinary Americans were playing at home in the days before mass media.
When the work of earth is done and the crown of victory won, we shall hear a welcome home up on high. He will bid us welcome there, give us mansions bright and fair. Oh, we sure shall all have glory by and by. Oh, the glory by and by. Oh, the glory by and by. In that home. Watch and pray by night and day, for we all shall have glory by and by.
There were a lot of hymns. Billy Lamb had already recorded for OK in 1927 with the group we just heard, the Greene County Singers, who were his wife, her brother, and her mother. Although their previous five records hadn't sold, OK gave them a shot with two more during this week.
It is a sign of judgment, yeah. It is a sign of judgment, yeah. It is a sign of judgment,
yes, oh Lord, the time is drawing nigh.
I say,
the time is drawing nigh.
You can read in Ephesians,
yeah. Time is drawing nigh.
I say,
the time is drawing nigh.
Oh, you can read it.
Unlike RCA, OK was looking for black talent, and they managed to draw several a cappella quartets, like the Golden Crown Quartet here. It's hardly surprising that their records flopped. This was a very old-fashioned style, and to the extent that gospel records were selling, it was earthier, more contemporary artists who were making them. But the weirdest hymn recorded in these sessions was this one. That's Whispering Hope, a classic, in a recording by the Tubi's Royal Hawaiian Orchestra, a group largely made up of employees of the local Tubi's Artificial Silk Company. Hawaiian music was big and getting bigger, and no tent show is complete without a Hawaiian band and hula dancers. But what led this group to decide that a hymn was their path to fame is anybody's guess. There was also, of course, secular music offered up by the hopefuls, including one blues performer who had a bit of a local reputation. Nobody's sure who Blues Birdhead was, although it's likely he was James Simons, a local entertainer who was a favorite with black and white audiences. But his record has some notoriety because of his odd, horn-like style. Then, of course, there was hillbilly music. Babe Spangler was probably the most famous local fiddler, having appeared on nationwide radio and won the 1927 Virginia State Fiddlers Contest. His two sides are the most professional in this entire set. The competition wasn't even close. Performance like the Salem Highballers' Snowbird on the Ash Bank was okay for a barn dance, but since it goes on for 3 minutes with almost no variation, it didn't make for such a hot record. The same could be said for the four sides cut by the Roanoke Jug Band, an old-timey group with a fiddle, guitar, mandolin, and banjo, but for some reason, no jug. The more I listen to this collection, the more of a disaster OK's trip to Richmond sounds like, but history dealt them the final blow. 3 days after OK packed up its equipment and went back to New York, the bottom fell out of the stock market, signaling the beginning of the end for America's first great recording boom.
Ed Ward writes about music from Berlin. Coming up, Dirty Pretty Things. This is Fresh Air. Director Stephen Frears broke through in films with Hanif Kureishi's culture class drama, My Beautiful Laundrette. Since then, his best work has taken him far afield, from the 18th century erotic intrigues of Dangerous Liaisons to the seedy pulp L.A. of The Grifters. His latest movie, Dirty Pretty Things, marks a return to the world of London immigrants and their desperate attempt to find a home in British society. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
In many underclass crime melodramas, you get a sense that the filmmaker is lifting up the rock to show you all the parasites scurrying underneath. But the characters in the English drama Dirty Pretty Things are hiding in plain sight. They're housemaids and busboys, taxi drivers, porters, and prostitutes. They're all recent immigrants to Great Britain, some of them illegal, some of them forbidden to earn money while they're waiting for visas. And there's a whole network of people, many recent immigrants themselves, who exploit them for labor, for sexual favors, even, as it turns out, for their innards. Dirty Pretty Things is directed by Stephen Frears from a script by Stephen Knight, an English TV veteran who helped to create the original Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Maybe it's a stretch, but I detect here a yearning, grasping undercurrent. The movie is a true life game show. Who wants to be a citizen, and what will you give up? The hero is a Nigerian illegal immigrant called Okwe, played by the English stage actor Chiwetel Ejiofor, who you'll be hearing a lot more about. He has a face that registers everything, even when he's impassive. We first see him driving a taxi in an iffy part of London. Later, at headquarters, he asks the boss for a better route, and he's furtively led into a back room where the boss pulls down his pants. It's not what we think. Okwe turns out to be a doctor, but bosses pulling down their pants is one of the movie's motifs, and it's rarely for medical advice. Okwe also works as a night porter in a small, discreet hotel alongside immigrant doormen and chambermaids when a prostitute named Juliet, also an immigrant, tells him he should check out a clogged toilet in one of the rooms. He discovers a heart, a human heart. Okwe brings his discovery to the hotel manager, played with unsavory relish by Sergi Lopez. The man goes by the name of Sneaky, and you'll know why in this scene.
What's this, lunch?
It was blocking the lavatory in room 510. It is a heart. A human heart.
What?
Perhaps you should telephone the police.
Police? You think I should call the police?
Senor Juan, someone is dead.
Okay. You speak to them. You found it. You do the talking. I will introduce you. What's your full name, Okwe? And you never told me where you're from. Or even, how come you're here in this beautiful country? Hello? Police? Yeah, got somebody wants to talk to you.
Hello? Hello? Hello?
The rest of Dirty Pretty Things is Okwe's struggle with his conscience. It's not in his interest to know, but he needs to know what's going on behind those closed doors. Whatever it is, it's monstrous, and it threatens to swallow a woman he cares for, a Turkish chambermaid called Sene, who's working illegally and dreams of escaping to America. Sene is played by the French actress Audrey Tautou of Amelie. She has to speak not only in English, but Turkish-accented English, and it gives her a roughness and a hesitancy that cuts through some of that Amelie Gamin shtick. Okwe is probably too much of a saint to be true, and the movie has a touch of Paul Mazursky's sentimental Moscow on the Hudson in its theme of fellow immigrants in this together. But director Frears and his great cinematographer Chris Menges charge the images with perverse wit. The film has an underground luster. The settings are back corridors and garages and alleyways and sub-sub basements. Okwe's only friend is a sardonic Chinese immigrant, played by Benedict Wong, who works in a hospital morgue. The two play chess games amid the gurneys, which are sometimes sterile and sometimes not. The whole movie is a little like that, gleaming, but with a whiff of the charnel house. It's a film about the immigrant culture that cuts to the bone, or at least to the vital organs.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies. The great Celia Cruz, the Cuban singer who became the queen of Latin music, died earlier this week at the age of 77. We'll close with her recording of No Encuentro Palabras, recorded in 1956.
En sueños yo te digo, pero despierto no encuentro palabras cuando estoy contigo, no sé qué me pasa. Ay, mírame, sí que me quieres, bésame, abrázame, dime que soy tu amor.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Ricky Skaggs, the Grammy Award-winning country and bluegrass musician. His new album is called The Three Pickers, and it features Skaggs playing along with Earl Scruggs and Doc Watson. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Oft I sing